I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Yesterday, most of the U.S. embassies and consulates that had been closed because of terror threats were reopened. The two that have remained shuttered are in Lahore, Pakistan, and Sana'a, Yemen. The U.S. has been engaged in an intense counterterrorism effort in Yemen, using drone strikes to attack and destroy al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, known as AQAP. The State Department said that concern about a possible attack by AQAP was the reason for keeping the embassy closed. Our guest in this portion of Radio Times today is Gregory Johnson, former Fulbright Fellow in Yemen, a PhD candidate in Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University, author of a book called The Last Refuge, Yemen, Al-Qaeda, and America's War in Arabia, joining us from the NPR Bureau in New York City. And Gregory Johnson, it's been a couple of years. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's always nice to be back with you.
What's the message the U.S. is sending by keeping the embassy in Sana'a closed?
Well, what it's saying is basically that it's still incredibly concerned about the threat coming out from al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, the group in Yemen. And as we've seen over the past 2 weeks, the U.S. has carried out 9 different drone strikes on targets there in Yemen. So the U.S. is very, very worried about what's happening on the ground.
And you're making a connection between the closure and these drone strikes?
Yeah, absolutely. So what we saw last week and going back several days is that the U.S. had intercepted a communication that was from the head of the group in Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and Ayman al-Zawahiri, the head of al-Qaeda's global network. And that led to the closure of all of the embassies. And then after those embassies and consulates were closed, the U.S. carried out a number of different drone strikes in Yemen. Essentially, what they were doing is trying to bomb targets in Yemen in the hopes that by doing so, they would keep this group al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, back on its heels to the point that the group wouldn't be able to make good on that terror threat.
And do we know anything about what was actually said between the head of al-Qaeda and the al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula?
Well, we know very little. I mean, this is one of the real difficulties that counterterrorism analysts in the U.S. intelligence community really have, is that you're getting these little fragmentary pieces of evidence. So it's almost like trying to put together a puzzle, but you don't know what the puzzle looks like, and you don't have all of the pieces. So they just have a few scattered pieces. They put them out on a table, and they try to come up with a coherent narrative about what a group like al-Qaeda is doing. And the reason for all the embassy closings going from North Africa into the Middle East was because they just weren't sure what they had. They knew there was a threat, and a very real threat, but they didn't know where, and they didn't know with any degree of certainty exactly when. And that's why the U.S., as the State Department said in its warning, out of an abundance of caution, decided to close so many embassies.
And do you think the attacks, so the fatal attacks in Benghazi, was part of the administration's calculations?
Yeah, of course. I mean, this is really the tragedy that led to Ambassador Stevens' death in Benghazi is something that will be with us going forward. And the U.S. State Department, any U.S. administration, whether Republican or Democrat, from here on out, is really going to have to tread a very, very careful line on this idea of risk management versus risk aversion. And that is, what risks are U.S. diplomats in places like Libya and places like Yemen, what risks are they willing to take? And what risks is the U.S. government back in Washington willing to take? Because it's very, very important for these individuals to be out on the ground, to be talking with individuals, to see what's happening in order to advise policymakers back in Washington. But when they're sort of shuttered and bunkered down in an embassy, there's a very real cost to pay. And so this is a fine line. And it appears that, again, in this situation, the U.S. wanted to err on the side of caution.
I thought it was interesting, though, that the Yemeni government, frankly, criticized the Obama administration, saying that this closure serves the interests of extremists.
Yeah, this was a very sharply worded message from the Yemeni government. And what made it so significant is that it came just days after President Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi, who's the new president of Yemen. He took over in the wake of the uprisings, the Arab Spring in 2011. And he had just met with President Obama only days before the embassy was closed. And it seemed like U.S.-Yemeni relations were quite close. And then the U.S. took this step to close the embassy in Yemen, as well as embassies around the Middle East. And the Yemeni government, of course, reacted very negatively to that.
Do you think they were right? that it has or is serving the interests of extremists?
I mean, that's a really good question, Marty, because what we have right here is essentially two different ways to see this war. So the U.S. is very, very concerned about what's taking place in Yemen. And the U.S., and this is something that concerns me as well, the U.S. seems to believe that it's in a position to fight and to win this war on its own. But that means that it's essentially the United States against Al-Qaeda in Yemen. And that's a war that the U.S. can never really win. President Obama is a very big fan of saying that the U.S. wants to disrupt, dismantle, and defeat Al-Qaeda. But the only people who are really in a position to do that in Yemen are the tribesmen and the clerics. But because the U.S. is carrying out so many drone strikes, and because there's a perception that many of these drone strikes result in civilian casualties, that essentially closes the space in which tribesmen and clerics in Yemen can sort of stand up and take the fight to Al-Qaeda. And so what we see is that it's Al-Qaeda, a group that's certainly unpopular in Yemen. The problem is that the U.S. is much more unpopular.
And you think the drone strikes are creating more support for AQAP?
Yeah, I mean, this is the real frustration, I think, for the U.S., is that the U.S. has been carrying out drone and airstrikes in Yemen since December 2009. And if you'll remember, on Christmas Day 2009 is when this group in Yemen, this Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, they put a would-be suicide bomber, someone we know as the underwear bomber, on a plane bound for Detroit. Since then, the U.S. has been carrying out a number of strikes. The most conservative estimates put it at about 82 strikes that the U.S. has carried out in the past 3.5 years in Yemen. But during that time, instead of Al-Qaeda getting smaller, instead of Al-Qaeda getting weaker, what appears to be happening is that Al-Qaeda is actually growing. So it's went from about 200 or 300 individuals all the way up to over 1,000 individuals. And as this past week and a half or so has shown, it's an organization that's still capable of sending the U.S. into panic mode. Drones can be a very, very powerful weapon, but they have to be used wisely and they have to be used judiciously. And to be quite honest with you, the U.S. is overusing them, and it doesn't really have a strategy. What it's doing is bombing in the hopes that Al-Qaeda won't attack it.
Well, I do want to pick up on that, but you wrote a piece recently about the bombing or the drone campaign, and the importance of something called THAR. This is, I guess, another word for revenge in Yemen. Help us understand what THAR means and how that perhaps is a pushback on our drone campaign.
Right. So what's taking place is that in the U.S. is very worried about Al-Qaeda. We've talked about this. The U.S. sees an individual, say, in Yemen, and there are a lot of individuals in Yemen who have a big beard, carry a gun, and talk about Islamic law. But that doesn't necessarily make them all members of Al-Qaeda. And so the U.S. might target someone who's an individual of Al-Qaeda, and they see him, and maybe this individual does indeed have ties to Al-Qaeda. The problem is that in Yemen, Al-Qaeda is mostly Yemenis, and so their membership within Al-Qaeda is not the only identity that they hold. They're also tribesmen. They also have brothers and fathers and cousins and nephews. And when they're targeted and when they're killed, particularly if they're an individual who's sort of a mid-level or a low-level foot soldier, they might be targeted as an Al-Qaeda member, but they're then defended as a tribesman. And so what we see is that the more people the U.S. kills, the more people are actually flowing into Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, not because they share this sort of radical ideology that Al-Qaeda espouses, but rather because they want to get revenge. They want to carry out THAR against the country, in this case, the United States, who killed their relative or who killed their fellow tribesmen.
Is that an argument to end the drone strikes, though?
Well, the drones, I'm not a proponent of ending all drone strikes in Yemen. I think drones can be a very popular or a very powerful tool. But I think the U.S. has to be much wiser in the way that it carries it out. And the problem I think that we often tend to overlook and the problem that the United States has in a place like Yemen is that it doesn't have very good human intelligence on the ground. That's really the Achilles heel of the United States. So drones are amazing. You can have a drone up in the air. It can hit a car that's driving down the road, miss all the other cars. But if the drone doesn't know which car to hit, it doesn't really matter that it's this amazing piece of technology. Mm. If it hits the wrong car, it's still a mistake. And so the U.S. needs this on-the-ground human intelligence. And that's something that for the past dozen years, we just have not been able to do very well.
Would that be like a special forces or some kind of working relationship with the current Yemeni government?
Well, this is something that I think the CIA really needs to change. So what we saw after September 11th is that this group, Joint Special Operations Command, JSOC, these are the sort of broad individuals who carried out the raid on Osama bin Laden. The CIA and JSOC essentially became mirror images of one another. So the CIA was traditionally an intelligence organization. JSOC was traditionally a military organization. JSOC started to do spying. The CIA started to do killing. And the CIA moved away from sort of its traditional roles of gathering and sifting and analyzing intelligence. And it's been that weakness that continues to come back to haunt the United States in places like Yemen, in places like Somalia, in places like Libya. The new CIA director, John Brennan, who was confirmed just a few months ago, is a career CIA officer. He's someone who was a station chief in Saudi Arabia. He said that he would like to move the CIA back toward its traditional role of spying, of collecting, of gathering intelligence as a way to make up for this shortcoming. But it's going to be a very long and a very difficult process. And what we're seeing right now is that the U.S. is paying the price for going away from the traditional role of spying and gathering intelligence. And when you don't have good intelligence, everything else is really dependent upon that. And that's the weak link in the chain.
Well, about a minute before our first break here, but if the U.S. were able to target and kill the leadership of AQAP, would that be the end of AQAP, or would people come to avenge those murders or those killings, I should say?
Right. That's a great question. So no one in Yemen is up in arms when the U.S. carries out a strike that kills a high-level figure in al-Qaeda. And this is what the U.S. says it's trying to do. The U.S. says it's going after about two dozen figures in Yemen, two dozen top al-Qaeda operatives. And it's been doing this for about 4 years. The problem is that the U.S. has killed in Yemen over the past 3.5 years somewhere between 600 and 1,200 individuals. Only a tiny fraction of those, about four, are these top al-Qaeda figures. And that's a real problem for the U.S.
And that's Gregory Johnson, our guest in this portion of Radio Times, talking about U.S. policy, counterterrorism, drone strikes in Yemen. He's a former Fulbright Fellow in Yemen, a PhD candidate in Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University, author of a book titled The Last Refuge, Yemen, Al-Qaeda, and America's War in Arabia. We are talking about Yemen, something the president talked about at his press conference on Friday. And we're taking calls. Any questions or comments you might have, do give us a call. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY Cornwall Manor, an active senior living community in Cornwall, Lebanon County. Situated on a 190-acre wooded campus, this community offers independence, wellness, and fitness activities, educational and musical programs, and the peace of mind of on-site health care if needed. Cornwall Manor's range of residential choices includes apartments and homes, including their newest options, the Carriage House and the Grove. Details and tour information online at cornwallmanor.org.
Hi, I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. Each week on Sound Opinions, we explore the world of rock and roll.
And we get some great artists, even enigmatic guys like Trent Reznor, to really bare their souls.
I just kind of come out of a period of inactivity where I was working on just being human again. That was me finding out if I could write sober, and finding out if anyone still cared, and putting fear in its right place.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
Here, now, in the moment.
It's a fast-moving stream of news and information. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. We are co-hosts for Here and Now, your source for news, updates, and great stories.
In the middle of your day, stay on top of what's happening.
With Here and Now, from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Don't miss a thing.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoeni. If you're just joining us, Gregory Johnson, author of The Last Refuge, is our guest. He's offering his analysis on U.S. drone strikes and counterterrorism in Yemen, talking also about Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, AQAP, Yemen, a country that our guest knows very well. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Greg, you mentioned the underwear bomber, as we call him. I'm also wondering about Dr. Hassan, who is on trial now, the Times Square bomber. Are there others that have had associations with AQAP?
Right. So Nidal Hassan, the Fort Hood shooter who's currently on trial, is an individual who reached out to Anwar al-Awlaki. This is a man that we know, an American-born cleric who the United States was very concerned about. The U.S. said that this was an individual who was the head of the foreign operations unit within al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, someone who was dedicated to attacking the United States. And in September of 2011, the U.S. killed Anwar al-Awlaki in a drone strike in northern Yemen. It's very unclear to me at this point what exactly the nature of the relationship between Anwar al-Awlaki and Nidal Hassan was, and to a greater extent, what the relationship between Hassan and AQAP. I think what we see and the real danger is that al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula and other groups are hoping to sort of inspire these terrorists to act on their own. So whether it be the Times Square individual, whether it be Nidal Hassan, they'd like to see more and more of these individuals carrying out acts of terrorism within the United States without necessarily being intimately involved in the communication and in the plotting, because as we saw very recently with the terror alert, these communications can be intercepted by the United States, and al-Qaeda is aware of this, so they want to sort of give this broad inspiration without sort of going into all the operational details.
But does al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, AQAP, is their mission then to attack the United States, their goal?
Right. So, I mean, this is one of the things that we in the U.S., I think sometimes get a little narrow vision, if you will, on a topic like this. So al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is certainly a terrorist group, but we in the West often see them only as a terrorist group. This is an organization that wants to, A, attack the United States, but they also see themselves as doing something much broader. So they'd like to implement their own form of government within Yemen, take over these little areas which they call emirates, where they can staff schools, where they can build water wells, where they can string electricity, where they can essentially be a de facto government. And in fact, in 2011, 2012, we saw al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula doing this in parts of Yemen. There were areas that had been petitioning the central government for years to send teachers, had never been able to get teachers sent to this very rural area. Al-Qaeda shows up, puts a bunch of men in school, and you can imagine what these men are teaching the young boys in the school. So this is an organization that has very deep roots in Yemen that wants to establish a firm base there. And out of that base, it wants to be able to carry out attacks on the Yemeni government as well as on the United States.
And does it want to turn back the clock in Yemen as well when it comes to things like human rights or the status of women, for instance?
Right. So this is an organization that wants to implement its own version of Islamic law. What we've seen, though, and what the organization appears to be realizing is that they need to be much more subtle than they have been, that they need to take a much more nuanced view. And this is where al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is actually in a better position than the United States in a hearts and minds campaign, because many of the members of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula are actually Yemenis. And so we've seen documents, there's been letters from the head of al-Qaeda that have been intercepted, that have been made public, where he talks about a gradual implementation of Islamic law. But ultimately, you're absolutely correct, Marty. They want to get to a point where they're implementing a very narrow version of Islamic law, where women are restricted to certain movements, where amputation of hands for theft, things like this are commonplace. But that's a long way off for the group, and it realizes that it needs to the old adage of attracting more flies with honey than vinegar is something the group's attempting to implement right now.
Let me get that. Looks like Katie from Arlington, Virginia, to join us on Radio Times. And Katie, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there. Excuse me for backpedaling here. I'm curious, you know, in the spirit of the non-conversion of people in Yemen, if you will, to al-Qaeda. What are the politics behind transparency of the U.S. government recognizing these 600 to 1,200 innocent civilian deaths that are caused over the last however many years now?
You're talking about the U.S. government acknowledging the civilian deaths because of some of these drone strikes, Katie?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Well, let me see if do you want to respond to that, Greg?
Yeah, absolutely. This is a very good question, and there's a very it's a very grim accounting battle that's taking place right now. So we know that there have been 600 to 1,200 deaths in Yemen as a result of U.S. strikes. What's being debated is how many of those are civilians and how many of those are individuals linked to al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. And part of the problem with this in sort of counting and determining which person goes into which category, well, there are a couple of problems. One is that it's incredibly difficult to identify bodies after a strike because they tend to be charred and tend to be very gruesome, and it's quite difficult to put the bodies back together again. The second is the way that the U.S. counts these individuals. So the U.S. has employed a very controversial counting tactic, which is basically that any military age male whom the United States kills, unless that individual can be posthumously proved to be innocent, the U.S. counts them as a militant. So this means that human rights groups who are very worried about what it is that the U.S. does, they tend to say that many of these individuals are civilians. The United States obviously says many of these individuals are militants. And so this is the debate that's taking place right now on how many of these people are civilians and how many are fighters linked to al-Qaeda. The problem in a place like Yemen is that the perception is just as important as the reality. So the reality may be that the vast majority of these are indeed individuals linked to al-Qaeda, but because the perception is that the U.S. makes so many mistakes and kills so many civilians, that's really something that is helping al-Qaeda's recruiting process.
How would you describe the Obama administration's relationship with the current government?
Right. That's a great question. So what we saw after the Arab Spring in 2011 is the old president, an individual who'd ruled for more than three decades, was pushed out. His vice president came into power. His vice president, President Hadi, had almost no domestic base of support within Yemen. So what President Hadi needed is he needed full-throated international support to make up, to offset the lack of a domestic base of support. So he relies on the U.S. for all of the support, and in turn, he gives the United States a green light to carry out strikes when and wherever it wants, which is why over the past 2 weeks, we've seen this rapid upswing number of drone strikes, 9 in 2 weeks.
Look, and we're almost out of time here, but so what advice do you have for the Obama administration? I realize you're not necessarily in the business of giving advice, but based on the scenarios that you have laid out to us.
Right. Well, actually, at different times, I have given advice. Many people who study in Yemen have. Most.
Well, I think we just lost our connection to our guest, and that was Gregory Johnson, a Fulbright Fellow in Yemen and a PhD candidate in Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University, author of a book called The Last Refuge, and it's subtitled Yemen, Al-Qaeda, and America's War in Arabia. In this hour of Radio Times, beginning our conversation talking about Yemen, something that President Obama talked about at his press conference on Friday, and now we want to talk about Russia. President Obama spoke at great length at his Friday press conference about U.S. relationship with Russia and his difficult relationship with President Putin.
What's also true is that when President Putin, who was prime minister when Medvedev was president, came back into power, I think we saw more rhetoric on the Russian side that was anti-American, played into some of the old stereotypes about the Cold War contest between the United States and Russia. And I've encouraged Mr. Putin to think forward as opposed to backwards.
President Obama is heading to the G20 summit in St. Petersburg in September while calling off his one-on-one meeting with Putin. And joining us now is Matthew Rajansky, director of the Russia and Eurasia program at the Wilson Center's Kennan Institute, where his work focuses on U.S. and Russia national security and nuclear weapons policies. And Matthew Rajansky, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, happy to be with you.
Nice to have you with us. And I'm curious about just the comments that President Obama made about Putin on Friday, the rather personal comments he made. One we did not include in that clip was his description of Putin's slouch like a student in the back of the classroom. What did you make of that?
This to me is a reflection of two things. Number one, it's the fact that the president has, in fact, personalized this relationship. That's not a good thing because it's not working with Putin. It worked reasonably well with Medvedev, although Medvedev being Putin's predecessor and also successor, he essentially kept the chair warm for Putin while he took this constitutionally mandated break from being president. Medvedev was a sort of a more of a technocratic government servant sort of fellow. He was a lawyer by training, just like Obama. The two got on just fine, and it just hasn't worked with Putin, whom Obama has consistently characterized as sort of a man of the old style of the Cold War, KGB spy, et cetera, et cetera. The other thing is, it's not working from Putin's perspective. He doesn't like the American style of politics. He doesn't like the jokey stuff that Obama tries to do. And the other thing is, he doesn't really go for the idea that, well, if what the United States is asking for is in Russia's interest, then obviously Russia ought to come along. So if the United States puts a proposal out there that is in some marginal sense or ought to be interesting to the Russians, why don't they just come along? Well, you know what? He doesn't trust the president. He doesn't think that the president can deliver. It's just a relationship at this point that on a personal level isn't working.
But the fact that Russia, Putin, offered Edward Snowden asylum, this was just a couple of days before the president's press conference, is that not a thumb in the eye of the president and the U.S.?
It surely is. There's no question about that. In part, I think this is Russia simply asserting its ability to do, to chart a course which is independent from America's wishes. This is really one of the distinctive characteristics of foreign policy under Putin, certainly as contrasted with Yeltsin's foreign policy in the 1990s, is the idea that Russia has once again come into its own as a global great power, as a global kingmaker, and in particular the idea that Russia will stand up to the United States when the United States tries to dictate outcomes internationally, places like Libya or Syria, pick winners, pick losers, decide when it's time for a regime to go. Of course, that too becomes personal for Putin because he knows very well that, you know, in his heart of hearts, President Obama and other American officials are not interested in the longevity of the Putin regime, would rather see him go as well. So fundamentally, this is a guy who just doesn't accept that America's interests and the President of the United States' stated wishes on an issue like Snowden or anything else are legitimate or should carry the day, and doesn't really care that there will be consequences.
But is this a return not to the Cold War itself, but to, I guess, maybe Cold War light relationship between these two countries?
Yeah, I mean, it's not about Cold War because the ideological component just isn't there. You know, we have no disagreement about the nature of politics and economics and things like that. They're not communists. They're capitalists just like us. But we have very serious disagreements on major international issues, Syria being one of the prominent ones. And then we have this growing, I think it's fair to say, values gap on domestic politics. Now, that's not to say that it's universally shared. There are plenty of Russians who find the American system very appealing and the American attitude about politics very appealing. And there are plenty of Americans who wish we would, you know, kind of get out of other countries' business on their domestic politics. But the basic dynamic has been, you know, Russia oppresses its opposition. Russia restricts its NGOs. Russia passes anti-gay laws. Russia mistreats its ethnic minorities. Whatever the issue is, the United States is up in arms about it, and the United States either officially, as the government, passes sanctions, as in the Sergei Magnitsky, the Justice for Sergei Magnitsky Act, which created a list of Russian officials who'd have their visas denied and their assets in the United States frozen, ironically at the exact same time that Russia joined the international free trading system by joining the WTO, or by American civil society or the American media. I mean, it's very interesting that just today a survey has cropped up on the New York Times website asking gays in Russia to talk about their experience of discrimination. A very legitimate thing to ask about and to be concerned about, but I can't remember the last time the New York Times singled out another country to ask about discrimination against gays or another issue. And so the Russian perception of all of this has been, you know, that the Americans are just paying unfair attention and being unfairly critical about Russia's domestic politics, and Putin is absolutely the poster child for that. Stay out of our business.
So what's your response to President Obama's canceling his one-on-one meeting with Putin? Was that a mistake?
My response, I hope, is consistent with what I've said, which is I completely understand why he's done it. I can understand why he's discouraged at this point. I think he's even factually probably right that he wasn't going to get a lot of return on his investment of time and political capital in that meeting. There are even some liabilities. For example, there will be an election for the mayor of Moscow, widely seen as the second most powerful job in Russia, a couple days after the date that the summit was scheduled for. So he might even have put himself in a position of sort of inadvertently endorsing what could then be a corrupted or even violent election process. So I completely understand why he did it. I nonetheless believe it was the wrong move. And the reason for that is, if you understand the Russian system, first of all, you know, Russia wants to be respected. And that goes for not just Russian officialdom, but ordinary Russians, people up and down the ranks of government and business. You know, they want to be taken seriously. And I think that this slap in the face of, you know, attending the G20 summit, which is being hosted by Russia in St. Right. Petersburg, but then explicitly refusing to meet with the head of state, it's really an uncalled for slap in the face. And then second, you know, if you ever want to make progress, and I think Obama is a leader who has to, because so many of his legacy issues depend on global peace and security, progress on nuclear disarmament, things where, you know, Syria, the Arab Spring, things where Russia actually does play a pretty important role, you got to get to the decision maker. You know, just having John Kerry and Chuck Hagel meet with their counterparts as they did on Friday, well, we saw what that resulted in, exactly nothing. You know, if you don't get to Putin, if you don't put the proposal to him, if you don't at least try to repair that relationship a little bit, the one thing you can be certain of is that progress will not be made.
We're almost up in a break here, but do you also risk just getting a kind of a photo op between these two presidents and not much else?
I would expect that they will have one of those short exchanges, possibly in front of the cameras in St. Petersburg. It's clear that Obama will not go on to Moscow. But what I would further expect, and I don't know what form this will take, I think the Russians will do something to signal their displeasure. If it's excluding the president from some kind of, you know, group hug of world leaders, I don't know what it is, but there will be some way in which the Russians, who are the hosts, they run the show in St. Petersburg, they'll signal that they're just not happy with the way things shook out.
We're going to take that short break, get back to our conversation with Matthew Rojansky. We're talking about U.S.-Russia relationships and the relationship between the two presidents, Obama and Putin. And our guest is director of the Russia and Eurasia program at the Wilson Center's Kennan Institute. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. New York internist Dr. Danielle Ofri will discuss her latest book, What Doctors Feel, at Fox Chase on Wednesday, September 18th at 7 p.m. What Doctors Feel explores how physicians' emotional responses have a profound effect on patient care. A catered reception will follow this public event. No ticket required. Copies of What Doctors Feel will be available. Registration and more at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center, now part of Temple Health.
I carried a suitcase of money, drug money, once, 10 years ago.
That's a clip from Orange is the New Black, the new Netflix series. It's based on the memoir by Piper Kerman. On the next Fresh Air, Piper Kerman talks about her year in a minimum security prison and seeing her story turned into television. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Memoirs, we read them all the time. Blue Nights by Joan Didion, Bossy Pants by Tina Fey, and Night by Elie Wiesel. Most memoirs are deeply personal. they enlighten and provoke as truths and half-truths are revealed. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, what memoir writing does for us as a means of self-expression and to help us heal.
Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, talking about the future of U.S.-Russia relations with Matthew Rojansky from the Wilson Center's Cannon Institute and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Matthew, let me just read something that the Washington Post said in their editorial about President and Russia, saying Mr. Putin, who returned office in May for a third term, has been carrying out a determined campaign to crush opposition at home, one dimension of which has been an ugly streak of anti-Americanism. He has harassed and attempted to destroy non-governmental organizations that receive funding from abroad, many of them worthy civil society goals. He's pushed through a ban on the adoption of Russian orphans by Americans in a fit of pique over U.S. law. We mentioned the Edward Snowden situation, and the editorial goes on to say, Mr. Putin's policies seem driven most of all by a desire to show he is standing tall. His approach has thrown the relationship with Washington into a downward spiral, essentially blaming Putin for this relationship with the U.S.
Right. So first of all, it doesn't surprise me that the Post editorial page is saying that. There's been a sort of long-term, I don't mean to pick on either the Times or the Post here, but there has been a kind of long-term streak of singling out Russia for this type of criticism from the Post as well. But look, the bottom line is almost every one of those criticisms is absolutely accurate. The problem is context, right? At the end of the day, whatever may be going wrong or right in Russia's domestic politics, we don't have the luxury of checking out from the U.S.-Russia relationship. So my concern about what we're looking at down the pipeline here for the next several months is that we've sent the signal to the Russians that we're really not interested in talking at the highest levels, and those are the only levels where decisions get made. And yet, this is a country that indisputably is going to play a central role in issues that we have said are critical to us. Syria is just the obvious example. Snowden is another one. They're not cooperating, but by the way, have we excluded the possibility that a deal can be done quietly and behind the scenes? One of the things that really surprised me about the handling of the Snowden affair from the very beginning was the idea that everything was so public. This was a big kind of almost moralistic demand that says, look, if you're on the side of justice and right and law and order, you will hand this guy over, as opposed to, what happened to kind of handling this thing quietly behind the scenes, letting him move on quietly to a third country where after a decent interval of time, he gets snatched up and returned to the United States. Everything I know about the Russians suggests that they would have been totally open to that if it had been handled in a way where they were offered something that they wanted quietly. They got it, and they delivered up what the United States wanted. But instead, this was all sort of, by politicians and by administration officials, this was all put openly on the record. Snowden's passport was very publicly revoked, and then it became a prestige issue. Then it became something where, Putin couldn't back down. Otherwise, he's clearly a pawn of the United States, and he loses his base domestically.
Let me ask you about Syria, and I think we can all agree that Syria is a critical issue, and obviously the United States and Russia see this conflict in very different terms. If you could get Putin together with Obama in a locked room somewhere, what would they talk about? How would they resolve these differences?
Yeah, I mean, I think the difference on Syria is not quite what we assume it is. I think it's not that Russians are callous to the violence that's going on there. They definitely are more cynical, more broadly speaking, in their foreign policy outlook. But it's the idea that they have not yet seen a variation on the kind of day-after-Assad scenario that they can live with. Part of that, of course, is because of the interests that the Russians, the very narrow national interests that the Russians have wrapped up in the Assad regime, their ability to base ships there, the contracts that they have, the weapons they've already sold and that are in the pipeline, that's all the case. But even if Assad were to go, and there have been different times over the last several months, even going back a year now, where you've heard the Kremlin flirt with the idea that maybe Assad himself and maybe even the whole Al-Qaeda regime and the whole system are not long for this world, because they are pragmatic about that. If he can't hold on, they're going to cut him loose. The question still arises, what happens to Syria? very, very concerned about Islamist extremism, not only in the sort of abstract, this stuff happens around the world way that Americans are, but this is in their own country. I mean, they literally have people who have experience and are picking up weapons and are trafficking other people to and from the Middle East coming into Russia, because they have a Muslim region in their own south where there is an open and violent insurgency. There have been lots of terror attacks. Proportionally, more Russians have actually been killed in terror attacks than Americans in 9/11. They're really worried about this scenario, and their feeling about a guy like Assad, sort of like the argument people made about Mubarak in Egypt, it may be totally amoral, but at least this is a guy who can defeat the Islamists. And that's where I think the big difference is, and that's really where we haven't presented an outcome that they like yet.
Let me see what Rick from Hoquesson, Delaware has to say. And Rick, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Yes, Marty, thanks for a wonderful show.
Thanks.
And I wanted to make a comment. I thought that President Obama's, who I respect very much, a very intelligent man, it was predictable that he would not receive go to see Putin, because we look down upon the Russians. And I think your author has spoken about it. And I go back to the 1980 decision of Jimmy Carter to not, for the U.S. team not to attend the Olympics, when we were looking down our nose about Afghanistan and what they did. At the same time, we were up to our waist in problems in Central America with troops everywhere doing counterinsurgency, the same thing that they were doing. And we didn't attend the Olympics. They paid us back 4 years later.
Well, Rick,
we're doing the same thing now, and my
well, we are going to the Olympics, if I can just put that out on the table there. But let me take your point, Rick. I mean, do you think Russia looks, the United States looks down on Russia, and how do you think Russia views the United States, Matthew?
I don't know that Americans look down on Russia. I actually think Americans, and I'm certainly one of them, have for a long time had a romantic fascination with Russian culture and music and literature. I mean, there are a lot of Americans who would travel to Russia if it were easier to get a visa. By the way, that's one of my big policy recommendations, is make it absolutely as easy as possible for ordinary people to travel. But on a political level, the problem that we have is that there's too little of this connective tissue. If you think about, you know, the U.S. relationship with Canada or with Mexico or with the U.K., or even, I would venture to say, with a country like France, where we have a lot of, frankly, moral and stylistic disagreements all the time and are constantly mocking each other, and yet the business relationships, the family relationships, the NGO relationships, the church relationships, the security relationships, they're all so thick and deep and strong that you can't imagine a scenario where even though, you know, a famous Frenchman, let's say, is caught molesting a maid in a Manhattan hotel, the whole relationship goes off the rails. Well, with the Russians, it's quite different. The relationship is very vulnerable because we don't have that foundation. And so a few things go wrong. Right, you have a defector or whistleblower, whatever you want to call him, who ends up in Russia, and it becomes a crisis for the relationship, as opposed to, well, it happens to be playing out in Russia, but this relationship is much bigger and much more important, and so we're going to keep on keeping on. Ironically, even though we have very vast differences with the Chinese on human rights, on security, on everything you can think of, the economic relationship is big enough, and it's a powerful enough incentive that you don't have the kind of rhetoric against China coming from Washington, Capitol Hill especially, that you have about Russia. The problem is there's just no downside for politicians to badmouth the Russians and to say that Putin is the enemy and to look tough, because we don't have enough at stake.
Mm. But I mean, it is interesting to compare the U.S. relationship with Putin versus Medvedev, and it seemed like a very different kind of relationship.
Yeah, that is true, and part of it was Medvedev's generationally different outlook, you could say, on the United States and on the West. I mean, he I think genuinely came up in a time in Russia where the assumption was that Russia was going to be a part of the West, and I think he wants to continue thinking in that way. You know, that may have changed, frankly, in his own life. You know, his experience over the last several years may have soured his own personal view on that. I don't have insight into his personal thoughts, but certainly his behavior indicated that he was very receptive to being a junior partner to the United States. That is something that Putin absolutely doesn't accept. He wants to be an equal. He and many other Russians see the need for the United States and Russia to sort of negotiate and hash out their differences, but on an equal playing field. And you know what? The reality of global power politics is not equality at this point. You know, mm-hmm. Russia is not as powerful, not as rich, not as big as the United States, and yet it's an important player. So we've got to find this modus vivendi. It's a difficult thing. I would never tell the president that he's ever guaranteed a positive return on investment from Russia. I think one of the big misconceptions that grew out of the 2009 reset is if you just talk better about Russia, if you just, you know, say, hey, let's clean the slate, let's have a mm-hmm. fresh start, things would necessarily work out better. And, you know, I think what we're seeing now is a return to the more normal pattern, which is it's slow going and it's difficult, but that doesn't mean that you disengage.
What do you think, though, the president of the United States should do about the fact that Putin did sign a law, I guess it was last month or certainly this summer, barring any public discussion of gay rights and relationships anywhere near where a child might hear that conversation?
Right.
Of course, this has implications for the Olympics being held there this winter. How should the United States deal with something like that?
This is an extremely hard issue, right? Because on the one hand, you see it in context. This is about Russia's domestic politics. This is not Russia trying to divide itself from the West, although that is clearly the effect that it has, and it does play into the anti-Americanism that the Washington Post was talking about. On the other hand, it could potentially be a real issue for athletes and for visitors, for spectators coming for the Olympics. There are other issues, by the way, like security, treatment of ethnic and racial minorities, etc. But the question of whether you boycott the Olympics over something like this, I think speaks to this fundamental question of style in foreign policy or strategy, which is, do you believe that engagement is a reward for good behavior, so you only talk to countries that are already doing the things you want them to do, or do you use engagement, and in the case of the Olympics, you know, sort of very fulsome, wholesome kind of international competition as well as a tool of engagement to try to influence countries to behave better in the future? My feeling is having that kind of event and having 145 million Russians have the opportunity to play host, to witness it, to be a part of it, is probably very good for exactly these kinds of problems in Russia in the long term about, you know, pluralism and diversity and acceptance and tolerance, rather than saying, oh, well, you know, you don't want to play the way we play, we're going to pull out.
Well, and so when President Obama said, you know, he hopes that gay athletes bring home the gold, the silver, and the bronze, that will be a potentially powerful message in Russia.
It certainly would be. I mean, you know, think about, I don't want to draw the analogy too far, but think about, you know, African-American athletes winning in Munich, right? I mean, it's a powerful message any time people who are in that kind of environment can be shown that the world is a more complex place, and in particular that, you know, people who they've had, you know, who they don't necessarily have personal exposure to, but that they've had portrayed for them in these vicious ways, you know, are different, and that there's something to appreciate about them. I think that is one of the great values of the Olympic Games. So I am 100% opposed to the notion that pulling out is, you know, what Russia deserves and will teach them a lesson. I guarantee you it will only take more ordinary Russians and convince them that, you know, America is unfairly victimizing Russia and sidelining it, and will ultimately serve the purposes of exactly the wrong people.
Let me give you a chance to respond to something else from the New York Times, and I'm just reading the first line, August 8th, so just over the weekend. A business owner in Russia has a better chance of ending up in a penal colony system known as the Gulag than a common burglar does. The idea that there's something like 110 people serving time for what Russia calls economic crimes, and I guess these are white-collar crimes or white-collar criminals serving time in Russian prisons.
Right, right. I mean, again, yeah, I'm not trying to pick on the media here, but it is something I see practically every day. The mere fact that this kind of reporting exists and we get so much of this negative coverage in Russia is partly because Russia's free enough that reporters can do this. And by the way, there's a sort of nasty little unspoken element. They're white, European, Christian. And that tends to make, in particular in Western Europe, it tends to make people think, oh, well, how can they be different from us? How can they have different paradigms than us? They look the same as us, or they, you know, act the same, or they practice basically the same religion. Bottom line here is bad stuff is going on in Russia, no mm-hmm. question. It is true that a lot of small business owners have been locked up. It's part of the wider problem of corruption. It's part of a system in which people are deeply cynical about business and making money coming out of the Soviet era. But a lot of Russians are aware of the problem, and they're working on the problem. But the idea that this is what we see about Russia, you know, that this is the characterization of Russia, is that this just totally dysfunctional place, amoral, immoral place, it doesn't help any of the fundamental investments that we need to make in fixing this relationship. Because at the end of the day, we do need them, we need to work with them, and I think a lot of Americans would like to have the kind of ties with Russians that have been very hard to establish over the years.
A minute before we have to say goodbye here. So what are some of the shared interests between these two countries?
No question. We both are interested in preventing nuclear proliferation and the kind of nuclear destruction that we looked down the barrel of during the Cold War. We want to prevent terrorism and other security threats. I think from different perspectives, both countries are interested in basic kind of energy security and stability. Both are interested in free trade increasingly over time as Russia becomes more prosperous. Certainly both countries are interested in increasing their direct economic ties one with the other. And I think ultimately at the end of the day, both are also interested, though they don't always agree about the details, in preserving basic international institutions. You know, the Russians like that they have a voice at the UN Security Council. They don't always use it the way we'd like them to use it. But these tools of international governance, they may be flawed, but if you tried to create them from scratch today, you probably wouldn't get anything nearly half as good.
Matthew Rodzianski, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Director of the Russia and Eurasia Program at the Wilson Center's Kennan Institute. His work focuses on U.S.-Russia relations, national security, and nuclear weapons policies. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including a Facebook, Twitter, email, archives, podcasts, satellite radio. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and stay with us. We'll be right back.